Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors, the Moorish Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and this evening we have some very, very important information for you. We're going to deal with administrative procedure and your estate. We're also going to be talking about the mechanics behind your birth certificate, how that thing got put in place, and a lot of different things. We're going to deal with start off dealing with the proper way to go at the DMV, how to do this thing, how to profit from this thing, and all kind of stuff. And we got a young man that's going to come up and give us some information on that in a minute. But first, let me get you let you know that as usual, we're giving our free articles away: the 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game, and How to Play, and the Truth about the United States. And you can get a hold of these documents simply by contacting me, Tahaka, at area code 904-303-9061 Eastern Standard Time, before 7 p.m. Also, we have your Black's Laws available, volume 1 through 9, and there's several other dictionaries that go along with that, and these are full dictionaries. And you simply contact me, 904-303-9061. Now, one other thing, for those of you who have my library, we have added a ton of information. The actual applications and templates for you to set up your last will and testament has been added to the library. We've added over 17 other different videos in there. Well, actually, about 23 of them. And just contact me, and if you can't find them, I'll let you know where they're at, because there's a ton of information in there. We're going to be dealing with what is meant by administrative procedure. How do we use this procedure in relationship to the courts and police? How do we deal with the DMV? How is your estate created? How do you profit from your estate? What is a trust? What creates a trust? What is a dash cam? What about your last will and testament, and how do we respond in court? And we're going to deal with that, how to actually go in there and respond. We want to try to do everything we can to keep from going in there, but if we find ourselves in there, how do we handle it once we get up in there? And we're going to deal with that this evening, okay? Now, I'm going to start off with dealing with this DMV thing. We're going to have a young man that's going to come in here and deal with that, so y'all hold tight. And if you got questions, comments, don't hesitate to raise your hand, and we'll see if we can get these things answered for you. And if you got comments to make, go ahead and hit me up in between these plugs, and we'll get your questions answered. Listen to what comments you have, okay? All right, let's roll.
Greetings. This is Tex. Welcome to THCTrust.org. Tonight, I want to talk about administrative procedure. I'm not going to get into the full scope of how you do an administrative process from start to finish. This conversation assumes that you're somewhat familiar with an administrative process, and I'm just going to point out some things to make you aware of that may make your administrative process even stronger and more enforceable. If you wish to learn from the beginning of what administrative process is and how to perfect one the right way to make it enforceable and to get the desired results that you're looking for, then visit www.thctrust.org and click the link that says Administrative Procedure under the Topics menu. And there is a in-depth video, which is the best that I've seen so far. And it's done by Brandon from Creditors and Commerce, and he explains how you do the administrative procedure. I'll start out by talking about one that I have before me right now, which is something that I was involved in, actually. There's a vehicle that belonged to our trust, and I'm one of the first trustees. And long story short, the vehicle was impounded. It was towed. And when we showed up to get the vehicle, we were told that, oh, well, you have to register it with the state of Georgia and this, that, and the other. And it wasn't the intentions of the trust to register that vehicle with the state because it's property of the trust. So anyways, when we went to retrieve the vehicle, we provided the bill of sale and all the necessary information regarding the trust and who I was as the trustee. And we were requiring them to release the vehicle. And they were like, oh, no, well, we can't release it until you register it with the state. So in that particular circumstance, I requested to speak to the person in the authority position that was on duty at the time. And a police lieutenant came out. And when he came out, I said, sir, may I speak to you in private? And he said, sure. So he took me over into a small room, and he had some other individuals with him. And I said, I would like you to know that I'm accepting you on your oath of office and your indemnity bond in regard to assisting the trust in resolving this matter, whereas you guys are holding on to a piece of our property and you're requiring that we register it with the state of Georgia before we release the property. So I pretty much told him that I needed him to supply me with some citation of authority or either a written court order or something written from a bonded official from their organization validating or certifying their authority to withhold the property. And he couldn't provide me with that. So I said, well, I'm going to need you to provide me proof of your authority to withhold our interest or the trust interest in its own property. I said, because in the absence of your ability to provide me with any authority to do so, then that constitutes your agreement to compensate the trust for $5,000 per hour for every hour that the property is not within, you know, our possession. Well, he laughed at it. He thought it was funny, as they typically do. And, you know, I didn't have no guns, no firepower. I can't fight them. So what I did, if you guys recognize, I just made a verbal contract with him. And he said, you know, we're not paying you $5,000 an hour. And we don't agree to that. I said, oh, yes, but you do agree to it because you haven't provided me with any proof of your authority to withhold the trust's property. And you haven't returned the property to us, and you agree that it does belong to the trust. So your failure to provide your authority to do so constitutes your agreement that you will pay $5,000 for withholding the trust property. This is in accordance with your behavior. See, that's tacit acquiescence. What I was doing was I was creating a contract with them in real time. So how that ended up playing out is I ended up leaving, and I left, and I went home. And as soon as I got home, I typed up a document called a memorialization of the agreement. And this is essentially, it's just worded differently, but essentially it's the same thing as an affidavit of fact, because the first thing in the administrative process is you have to lay the groundwork, the framework, which is the facts of the matter of what actually occurred. And I have it sitting here in front of me. I won't read through the whole thing, but I'll paraphrase, and it basically says, just as I told you, you know, it says, so it's a memorialization of the agreement. And it's expressed in the form of an affidavit, and it says background. On such and such day, it talks about, you know, when they took possession of the property, and it goes through the whole story. But the most important thing is it expresses in here that an agreement was made with Lieutenant John Doe that his inability to provide, you know, it goes through everything. He was accepted on his oath of office and required as a trustee to provide a remedy for them withholding the property without proving the authority to do so. It also expressed that there was an agreement. You know, it didn't say I asked any questions. It says there was an agreement established between myself as the first trustee on behalf of the trust and Lieutenant John A. Doe that the lieutenant agrees to pay to compensate the trust $5,000 per hour for every hour that they're withholding the property for their inability to provide proof of their authority to do so. And when I did that affidavit of truth, plain statement of fact, memorialization of the agreement, I sent it to him. Now, you have to look at this from his perspective. When he got this document saying that there is an agreement in place in accordance with the statement that I made under oath, what can he say? Because he clearly remembers having the conversation. There were other people in there. So now he's in a tough position because he can't come back and say, oh, I didn't agree to pay them $5,000 per hour for holding onto the property. Because he can't say that unless he can still provide proof, unless he can hold up to his end of the offer, which is the only way you can not give the property back and continue to hold on to the property is either you pay $5,000 or you provide proof of your claim in the form of a court order or some type of bonded document certifying the authority to withhold the property. So he couldn't do any of that. So essentially the only thing he could do was sit there and acquiesce not only to the verbal agreement, which he already did, but also to the memorialization of the agreement, which is the contract that I sent him. So he defaulted on that, okay? And remember, he laughed when I first presented the offer to him. So he defaulted on it, and once he defaulted, I waited till a good 10 days. I gave him, I say, hey, you have 10 days to respond to this memorialization of the agreement to whether, to rebut or provide your own statements on a point-by-point basis to invalidate this, basically. And there's technically nothing he can say because you can't answer that unless you go under oath in writing and provide your proof of authority to withhold the vehicle. And there is no law that says that they can withhold property. There's no law that says you're required to register anything. So he defaulted to those terms. And after he defaulted, I let the bill run up until it got about $2.4 million, and I sent him a bill for it. And he defaulted and he didn't pay. And I sent him another bill. And all this was done by notary presentment, which is a key part of the administrative process. You must do this through notary presentment. You can get around not doing it through notary presentment, but if it's something that's very important that may get a lot of eyes when you perfect it, then you got to do it. And when the process got boring and it got blurry and I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, I had to be persistent and continue to follow through the process. That's the thing. You can't be lazy with this. If you embark on this journey, you got to follow it through to the end. So now after he defaulted on it, now he's got a serious problem on his hands because now this is in the mayor's office and it's at the chief of police office, and I've received a couple of telephone calls of people trying to contract me out of my position, which is not going to happen. Now this is like, 90 days later. And now he's got a serious problem on his hands because, again, I've given him, and that's the thing with these administrative processes, you have to give ample time. You let them know where you're going with it, and they can laugh all the way until it becomes a serious issue, which they have a serious issue now. I take my administrative processes, which is something I'm going to talk about in this video right here, and I get them witnessed by the notary. Certified by the notary, I get a witness on the notary seal, and then I get it authenticated at the Secretary of State's office. So now, whether I file a lien or I take this claim out against the person's bond, no one can challenge this because it has three witnesses on it, and these witnesses are officials of the state. So in order to challenge the validity of this claim, you're going to have to challenge the notary, you're going to have to challenge the clerk of the Superior Court and the Secretary of State. So this is a very powerful document, and somebody's going to have to deal with it. So I'll keep you guys updated on how that turns out. But for now, let's talk a couple of details about administrative procedure. And again, remember, if you want a detailed detailed instruction that tells you how to do the administrative procedure, then make sure you go to thctrust.org and click the administrative procedure link and watch the hours worth of videos there. And I highly encourage that you learn this process, because I don't go to court. You know, I handle as much as I can outside of court, and that's what you should do, because if you can do this administrative process, you will be able to resolve almost anything, from speeding tickets to mortgage issues to, it's unlimited. But this is how you deal with things without having to put your face out there, without having to subject yourself to the games and the sideshow that takes place in the public court. Now, to learn how to do a proper administrative procedure, visit thctrust.org, click the administrative procedure link on the left side of the page, and there will be more than enough information, including some videos, that take you through the step-by-step process of doing an administrative procedure by way of notary presentment. And the full scope of the notary presentment is also explained there, and there's also template documents that I'll have there, so you will know how to prepare the notary's certificate of service and the notary's cover letter. But the purpose of administrative procedure, for anybody who may not know, is the administrative procedure allows for you to resolve your issues prior to going to court or without going to court. And if you are one of those people that just feel you have to go to court anyway, then by first perfecting an administrative procedure, you don't have to go in there trying to argue or convince the judge to see your position, and you really don't have to be subject to the different games and the jurisdictional games that they may try to play, because you would have already have established the facts, you know, of the record that you need to establish. So you don't have to go in there, argue, or prove no point. And again, that's why a lot of this video is going to be directed at how you use the administrative procedure when you finish with it. Now, the first thing I'll say is, when you do, everybody does these administrative procedures, but I would highly recommend that you make sure your administrative process is conforming to the timelines and the procedure that's set forth in the Administrative Procedure Act. And that's in Title 5 of the United States Code, somewhere around Section 530. The whole Administrative Procedure Act would be at thctrust.org for you to download under the Administrative Procedure link. But I highly suggest, now you're not required to use the timelines and to bring your process in conformity with the Administrative Procedure Act, because all those public laws, statutes, and codes apply to those that are in the public, which means the public officers and the trustees, et cetera, et cetera. However, because we know that they're required to follow those statutes, and we know that that the Federal Code of Regulations apply to them, then we want to make sure that, you know, we speak a language that they can understand, so that there could be no excuse as to why they didn't honor our process or our consent judgment, because essentially that's what our administrative process is doing. It's establishing the facts, and when those facts go unrebutted, they become a consent judgment. So again, remember, we're not restricted to the statutes or the federal regulations. The federal employees are, but it'll only be wise for us. See, we can hold them accountable to those things. They can't hold us accountable to those things. So it'd be wise for us to perfect our process in the way that has been designated for them, so that they won't have a leg to stand on. Also, making sure we conform to the Administrative Procedure Act gives us an enforceable lien right off the bat, an enforceable claim. And if someone ever tries to challenge you on a matter that has already been established by your consent judgment and your administrative procedure, as soon as they bring that claim in the public, you will have a certified record evidencing that everything they're saying is hearsay and false. And evidence is what matters. And I'm going to bring that concept up again a little bit later. Part of the reason why a lot of people can't get their administrative process to apply the way they want it to apply is because they don't know how to use it as evidence. And that's important. It's not just about filing it in a court record or sending it to the judge. You have to make it a part of evidence, and there's something that you have to do in order to make that happen. We're going to go into that a little bit later, and we're also going to just browse through the Administrative Procedure Act, and I'm going to point out some things that I highlighted so that you can instantly bring your administrative process in conformity with the Administrative Procedure Act, which is, for the most part, just making sure you give them the appropriate time. And this is also because once we perfect the administrative procedure and we have our consent judgment, you immediately have an enforceable lien right. So if you're having an issue with someone not trying to respect the facts as they have been established in your administrative procedure, then that person is standing in the way of your remedy, and they're prejudicing your rights, and therefore they attach to the procedure, you know, because they're withholding interest that is due to you as established by the agreement, which is your administrative procedure. And you can use your administrative procedure or your consent judgment to file a lien against them, and that could be the supporting document. Now, again, that's another reason why it's highly recommended that your process be in accordance with the Uniform Judgment Enforcement Act, because a lot of people like to throw out in the public that the sovereign citizens like to file bogus liens. Well, if you follow the process laid out in the Administrative Procedure Act, no one can challenge the validity of what you've done. No one would dare come out their mouth and declare your lien is bogus, because they'll be setting themselves up to be attached to it. And when you start affecting people's purse and their wallets, then they don't want to be involved. They'd rather go the other direction. Now, let me just go into one of the things that I don't see people doing in their administrative procedures that is very important. And this is because the administrative procedure is worthless if you can't enforce it. And one thing that I've just learned, one thing that I've learned through much experience is, in order to make your administrative procedure enforceable, you have to give it some type of monetary value. Because if you haven't realized by now, everything in the public deals with accounts, even in court. That's why they say they bring you up on charges, how many counts. It all deals with money. And the reason why people go to jail is because they have unpaid obligations, if you will. So they have debts to society or whatever. So since you're doing this in a foreign jurisdiction, you know, you have to give it a monetary value. And you need to do that. So if you ever have to enforce in the public, or you have to remove roadblocks, the only way that things move in the public is the commercial money system. Everything is an account. So remember, your administrative procedure is a statement of unrebutted facts. What is that? It's an affidavit. Or it's a charging instrument. And what is a charging instrument? It's a bill. So if you have an administrative procedure that's perfected and it doesn't have a value assigned to it, when it comes to enforce, what are you claiming an entitlement for, right? You can't file a lien against someone that doesn't have any value, and you can't expect someone to not trespass upon your process if there is no value to be held accountable for. The way that you have to bring a value is you have to declare positive law. You can't just say proof of claim that I'm required to have a driver's license and proof of claim that, you know, I'm required to follow the statutory code. You have to bring your laws that they are violating and assign a value to each of the violations unless they can prove that they've had the authority to do what they've done, right? And I think in Winston Strout's process, he charges them $10,000 per every constitutional violation. So at the end of the administrative process, there's a value assigned to it. If you're clever, you don't always have to use constitutional violations. You can use any kind of rights of yours that they trespass against. And you create a monetary value for them. Say, for example, if somebody was a credit card situation, somebody's trying to allege that you owe them $5,000 for something that you've already settled via an administrative process, or maybe you did a discharge of the debt through acceptance for value, and you've confirmed it by administrative process. Well, when you receive that letter to where they're still trying to collect, you can let them know that, hey, this matter has been settled in accordance with the facts right here. If you continue to try to collect without bringing some new type of agreement or validating this debt that you're charging me with, then you're prejudicing my interest in this account that has already been settled. And that makes you liable for that sum, or three times the amount of my interest that you prejudiced. So what is your interest in an account that you settle? That's the principle. You know, back into the double entry bookkeeping. For every liability, for every asset, there has to be a liability. Whenever there's an account that you're associated with, if it's an account for, say it's a loan, you know, for $100,000. Well, when you sign the promissory note for the loan and they commercialize that, that's the asset that funds the account. And that asset, again, is the principal, and that's what you're entitled to. So someone prejudicing your rights in a debt that you settle is prejudicing your interest in the asset, which is the total amount of the account. And you can let them know that they're liable for two to three times that. And that's not just for settling debts. It's for any type of criminal matter, mortgage matter. You always make sure your administrative process has a value assigned to it. And I also want to mention that if you ever have to bring your administrative process, well, let me put it like this. Say, for example, you're responding to a matter where someone wants to potentially bring criminal charges against you. Then you need to look at the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, especially if you're a Moorish American or someone who is completely foreign to the jurisdiction of the United States of America, because your claim should be constitutionally based or treaty based, since you're going over those jurisdictions. And the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is the perfect document that you need to be looking at if you need to establish enforceable rights for something that's criminal in nature. So again, make sure that you establish a value in your administrative procedure. It's highly recommended that you follow the timelines and the procedure that's laid out in the Administrative Procedure Act, which is Title V of the United States Code. And when you complete your administrative procedure, you want to get it authenticated so that it is in compliance with the Uniform Judgment Enforcement Act, so that if you have to take your administrative procedure, which is your consent judgment, into another jurisdiction, it can be acknowledged and recognized. Now, let me talk a little bit about that, because that seems to be a problem that a lot of people are having, and that is that they're not getting their administrative procedure recognized. Well, when you complete the administrative procedure, the first thing that you need to do is you need to put it in the public record. Now, technically, you're supposed to, you know, file this thing the same place where you will file, where you will register any other security security instrument. So you would want to file it wherever your county recorder records deeds. Now, sometimes you're going to have problems with that. Some court clerks and county recorders will not want to record such things. So the first thing you need to ask them is say, okay, well, where do you guys do just general filings? And if they can't answer that question for you, then just tell them you want to file it where they file deeds and mortgage deeds and liens and everything else. And if they want to deny you that opportunity, then you can consider filing, you know, registering the whole process on a UCC-1 and filing it in the record that way, or you can take the whole process and take it down to the district court and make it a general filing. Something else that you can do, which I can't go into complete detail of how you do this, it'll take some creativity on your part. You can take that whole consent judgment and you can pretty much create a cover page for it and make it a trust agreement. So it's a consent judgment, but you can establish it as a trust agreement. And you being the grantor of that trust and assigning the, you could assign the public in general or the public trustees as the trustee for the trust. Only reason why I'm saying you can do that also is because then you can have trust agreement at the top of the whole process. And then you can go down to the county recorder and say, well, I want to file this where you file trust. Or trust agreements, because at the end of the day, a lot of these people are just going to look at the front of your document and make a determination, even though they're not allowed to, of whether they're not going to file it and where they're going to file it and all of that. But the bottom line is you have to make it a part of the public record. Why is this important? Because then if you ever have to use it, it becomes evidence. If it's not already in the public record and you just try to take the process and send it to the judge in chambers, or if you try to just file it in the record jacket of the case and it's not already a part of the public record, meaning it's recorded in the deed book somewhere, then it doesn't become part of the evidence. It just gets filed into the record jacket. And that's key. In order for you to have results using the administrative process, it needs to be evidence of the facts that you have established. So in order for it to be evidence, it has to be already a part of the public record. That's just something for you to know about. Looking at the Administrative Procedure Act, Title V of the United States Code, and this is what all government agencies, and that means anyone who's acting in the capacity of a government agency. So again, even if we're settling our debts, dealing with the CFO of different companies, those are government positions, and he falls under the definition of a government agency. So that CFO is also required to adhere to the provisions set forth in the administrative procedure. So I made a couple highlights in here. Here's a particular thing I just highlighted because I found this interesting, and you can just use this as fuel in your responses and when you deal with these different agencies. It says, a final order, opinion, statement, or policy, interpretation, or staff manual, or instruction that affects a member of the public may be relied on, used or cited as precedent by an agency against a party other than an agency only if, one, it has been indexed and either made available or published as provided by this paragraph, or two, the party has actual and timely notice of the terms thereof. So when you're dealing with somebody that's standing in the way of your remedy and they're trying to make up policies, but they have no proof of what they're talking about, you can work this right here in your administrative procedure. I just put a note here, and it says, this means the agency would need to provide you of its claim that you had timely notice before using any order, opinion, or interpretation against you, essentially. So that's just something I highlighted in here. I'm going to put this document on the website with the highlights. Let's see what else I've highlighted in here. No agency may require advance payment of any fee unless the requester has previously failed to pay fees in a timely fashion, or the agency has determined that the fee will exceed $250. Okay. Okay, now here's something here, Section C. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, the defendant shall serve an answer or otherwise plead to any complaint made under this subsection within 30 days. So there you have it. They have 30 days in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act to correct the records or answer you based off of what you file. So that's why I always say it's good to start out in your initial correspondence by giving them 20 days to respond. And then when they don't respond in 20 days, then you can give them the notice of fault opportunity to cure, giving them an additional 10 days. Because then you have your default and your notice of fault opportunity to cure, and then you have another default that goes into the judgment. And at the same time, they've had a total of 30 days. So you see how that works. Here's something else interesting. The court may assess against the United States reasonable attorney fees and other litigation costs reasonably incurred in any case under this section in which the complainant has substantially prevailed. Now, that's just an interesting piece of information. We're not doing the administrative procedure so that we can take it in the court. At least, well, I don't do them so that I can take it in court. I do them so I can create enforceable claims, so I can foreclose on them if I have to, if someone continues to trespass. But if you have to take this in the court and make your administrative process a part of your counterclaim, right here it says that you're entitled to attorney fees, litigation costs, et cetera, et cetera. Let's see. Here's something else that's interesting. So if you do have to make your administrative procedure a part of a court hearing, of course you need to be in the district court, the federal court. Special counsel shall promptly initiate a proceeding to determine whether disciplinary action is warranted against the officer or employee who was primarily responsible for the withholding. You see how they're talking about the withholding? The person that's withholding is the person that's prejudicing your rights. Okay? The special counsel, after investigation and consideration of the evidence submitted, shall submit his findings and recommendations to the administrative authority of the agency concerned and shall send copies of the findings and recommendations to the officer or employee or his representative. The administrative authority shall take the corrective action that the special counsel recommends. These are just interesting things, again, that you should be aware of. Okay, this deals with the timeline. Each agency, upon any request for records made under paragraph 1, 2, or 3 of this subsection, shall determine within 10 days, except Saturdays, Sundays, and legal holidays, or in legal public holidays, after receipt of any such request, whether to comply with such request, and shall immediately notify the person making such request of such determination, and the reasons therefor, and of the right of such person to appeal to the head of the agency any adverse determination. So that means when you present your claim, I know a lot of people is looking at this and say, well, this is talking about a request for records. Well, if you do a settlement on an account and you're requesting an authentic statement of account to certify that the balance is zero, that's a request for records. Now, again, what this section that I highlighted here is telling you is that if for whatever reason they don't want to comply with that, then they need to let you know why they made the determination and what policy or procedure from the corporation have, you know, are they acting from? Where do they get their authority from? And if they don't give you any of that within 10 days, then by tacit acquiescence, they've accepted. You know, they accepted your contract. But essentially, like I say you give them 20 days in the beginning. So 10 days go by, now you know they're locked into it. 20 days go by and there's no response. You know, then notice a fault, opportunity to cure, etc. It basically says they can, you know, request time. In unusual circumstances as specified in this subparagraph, the time limits prescribed in either clause or clause of subparagraph A may be extended by written notice to the person making such request. So they had to send you a written notice if they're trying to extend the time. Any person making a request to any agency for records under paragraph 1, 2, or 3 of this subsection shall be deemed to have exhausted his administrative remedies with respect to such request if the agency fails to comply with applicable time limit provisions of this paragraph. That means if they don't get back with you and the timeline allowed, then you have been deemed to exhaust your administrative remedies. So, you know, nobody can say he didn't exercise due process before he filed this lien or before he took some other form of enforcement action, because if you've done your procedure in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act, then you will have been deemed to have exhausted your administrative remedies. All right? Upon any determination by an agency to comply with a request for records, the record shall be made promptly available to such person making such request. See? Promptly. Any notification or denial of any records, of any request for records under this subsection shall set forth the name. Listen, so if somebody's going to deny or they're going to withhold your remedy, they have to provide their name, title, position of each person responsible for the denial of such request. See, they're giving you the information that you need to hold them accountable, and they're required to. So just know where this is. So when you start requesting that information, who in the organization made the authority to deny me such a request? I need his name, I need his title, I need his position, I need his supervisor, as he's required to give to me in accordance with Title V of the United States Code. There's a lot of good things in here for you. Now, each agency that maintains a system of records shall, upon request by any individual to gain access to his record or to any information pertaining to him which is contained in the system, permit him, and upon his request, a person of his own choosing, which you might want that to be a notary, to accompany him to review the record and to have a copy made of all or any portion thereof in a form comprehensible to him, except that the agency may require the individual to furnish a written statement authorizing discussion of the individual's record in the accompanying person's presence. And they're also required to permit the individual to request an amendment of the record pertaining to him. Now, basically this says, after you review the record, you can ask them to, you can demand actually that they correct or modify the record, and you can give them 10 days to do so. And if they refuse to make the correction, again, let's read right here. It says, once you request that they modify the record, they have to make any correction of any portion thereof which the individual believes is not accurate, relevant, timely, or complete. Or, and this is if they don't want to make the correction, they have to inform the individual of its refusal to amend the record in accordance with his request, the reason for the refusal, the procedures established by the agency for the individual to request a review of that refusal by the head of the agency or an officer, etc., etc. So again, when you request that they correct a record, they have to either do it or they have to respond giving you the reason why they're not going to do it. And again, if they give you the reason why they're not going to do it, it has to be something that has already been established by policy in writing, as we learned earlier. And if it doesn't, then again, you have a withholder on your hand, and you need to structure your process to make him liable for the for your interest in the matter of which he is prejudicing by his actions of withholding. Okay. I hope this isn't too complex for you guys. And once you get in there, and when, if you go learn how to do the administrative procedure, it'll all make sense. You just got to get in there and do it. There's going to be samples on the site. So, again, this is the way that you fix things without having to go to a court, without subjecting your body or your vessel to imprisonment and all the other commercial processes. Now, here's one more very interesting thing, and something that I pretty much learned. Persons entitled to notice of an agency hearing shall be timely informed. So you can request an agency hearing if you're dealing with a government agency, and I assume this is even for a debt settlement, you know, request an agency hearing. And they have to make you timely informed of the time and the place and the nature of the hearing, the legal authority and jurisdiction under which the hearing is to be held. Read about this, because there's a whole procedure laid out to where you can have a an agency hearing with an administrative official there. So you can perfect an administrative procedure first so you can have your evidence and then call for an agency hearing to get the issue resolved right there. Just read through this, some interesting things in there. And I'll kind of leave it at that because this video has gone long enough. But make sure you visit thctrust.org so you can learn how to do the administrative procedure. And I welcome you to send me any emails of specific requests or things that you don't understand. And I'll have more than enough samples and more than enough information covering the administrative procedure at www.thctrust.org.
You guys having a good time tonight? Any first timers here? Raise your hand so I know who not to talk to. All right, first timer, 1, 2, 3, 4. Welcome. Nice to have you all here. My name's Billy. Bill for short, Bill for long, nothing more, nothing less. We're going to go over some executor things, and that has to do with estates. And it's if you guys don't understand that yet, we can get into it a little bit after the meeting, just a little bit so you understand. So I don't want to lose you. But a few years ago, approximately on your birth date, there was a death. Your birth certificate is the proof of that death. Anything spelled in all capital letters name, if you look up definitions into the U.S. code, it says that it is a deceased or a vessel. It can be any of those things, or a corporation. The word corporation, we know, comes from the word corpse, which means a dead thing. So as we learn these terminologies and what they really mean and how they apply to our life, it's really great to understand the word executor. Now, I like to call it an executor because they execute things. They execute plans. They execute problems. And I'm just going to go on a little bit about this and read it to you so you understand. And if you are a secured party creditor or a principal, this is really good information so that you understand how we're supposed to conduct ourselves. It says, it's both an honor and a burden to serve as someone's executor, as an executor is entrusted with responsibility for winding up someone's earthly affairs, a big or little task depending on the situation. Essentially, an executor is charged with protecting a deceased person's property until all debts and taxes have been paid, and seeing that what's left is transferred to the people who are entitled to it. The law does not require an executor, also called a personal representative, to be a legal or financial expert, but it does require the highest degree of honesty, impartiality, and diligence. This is called the fiduciary duty. The duty to act with scrupulous good faith and honesty on behalf of someone else. Executors have a number of duties, depending on the complexity of the deceased person's financial and family circumstances. Typically, an executor must, and I'm just going to go over the all bold things here, find the deceased person's assets and manage them until they are distributed to inheritors. Decide whether or not probate court proceedings are needed. Figure out who inherits property. File the will in the local probate court. Handle day-to-day details. Set up an estate bank account. Use estate funds to pay continuing expenses, pay debts, pay taxes, and supervise the distribution of the deceased person's property. That sounds very boring, doesn't it? I mean, it's just kind of a bummer. But what if, for entertainment purposes only, we were talking about your legal entity? Your name, in all capital letters, is an entity. Some refer to a trust. So if that legal entity died at birth, and you've been walking along not understanding that there is a large fortune there for you to take care of all the issues that we just talked about, wouldn't that be great if you were the executor?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say we read this again with that in context. I find out that the heir to all of this wealth, because I was born in America, has been given to a trustee that may fall under a heading of U.S., and they have been acting as the executor because I'm not old enough to understand all that. Let's say I'm a juvenile delinquent, like they call me in Title 18, because I haven't stepped up to the plate and said, hey, I'm the executor, and I'm going to do some things here to show that. Let's say I revoke power of attorney, and I appoint myself as the settlor. That sound good? And now I'm going to settle all the things that are required, and I'm going to do them with honesty, impartiality, and diligence. So the first thing I want to do is I want to notify the Social Security Administration that the guy that they're representing died. And now I need to notify maybe some alphabet companies, corporations that are saying that there's some debt owed to, maybe taxes. So I would open up an account so that I could affect payment to all those entities. Does that make sense? This is exciting stuff, because the accounts are real, and the players are all real, and the actors are real, and they're real matrix. So now, if we pay off all the taxes in, let's say, an executor situation where there was a trust and the person died, that would be the testator. Okay, so the testator is gone, and we need to settle up, because as soon as we get all the taxes paid and we get all the debt paid, now there's some extra things that we need to do. We need to find out who the beneficiaries are. I like that, because I would like to be the beneficiary. And as the executor, we get to appoint that. Now, if we figure out that the dead guy, the testator, has some property, we'll be able to claim that too. Now, has anybody ever heard of a property list attachment A? Raise your hand. Oh, there's a lot of us out here. So we already know what the property is. Giggle, giggle. We also need to notify the probate court. Now, that's going to be real easy, because all the courts in this government corporate venue are probate courts. Every one of them. Now, that's really good news, because we don't have to go looking for one. They're all there. Now, you might get a notice every once in a while. It's an offer to pay some taxes at, say, a traffic place or a magistrate place. All those things are already in place for us to go present that we are the executor for the trust, and we want to settle up. Now, there's 10 rules of commerce. I've talked about this a bunch. You can buy it online if you pull up the Google and search for it, 10 Rules of Commerce. There are a few copies floating around in this building I know of, if you want to borrow it and watch it. But the first rule of commerce is that you cannot control that which you did not create. Second rule is You can only control that which you create. The third rule, this is really cool. Are you liking this, Brad? This is really good stuff. It's just, it's so simple. And they give us manuals called executor manuals so that you can understand how to handle your estate. The third rule is that you cannot interfere with commerce. And I'm getting real close to it right now. So I'm going to be real careful that I don't interfere with commerce with anyone in here that may be a U.S. citizen. Because if you want to be a U.S. citizen, we're all for that. That's great. There's a whole bunch of us in here that are not U.S. citizens. I don't want to get too far out of the line there. But an MSO is a title. Everybody here gave up title to something along the way. If you have a driver's license, you gave up title to travel. If you have a license plate on the back of your car, you turned it into a vehicle when you did that, and you gave up title. And by giving up title, you give up the rights and the profits from that for a benefit and privilege. So the thing that scares a lot of people is they get really depressed about all this and say, well, I gave up everything. How do I get it back? So I did another word study. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about regaining title. Okay, let's show you what a title really looks like. This is, says a certificate of live birth that was printed up at the hospital, and they send it off. It's a little card, and they make it smaller so that it fits really nice on top of a securities instrument. A securities instrument, you can tell is a securities instrument because it has this really nice border around the outside edge. At the very bottom of this one, does it have a bond company? At the bottom of my birth certificate, they hid it in the scroll, that really nice border that has all the fancy penmanship, all that stuff. Mine is hid in there. In fact, I got one from the county, and I got one from the state, and they bonded it through two different securities companies, corporations. One of them was American Bond and Note Company, and the other one was a Midwest Bank and Note Company. So just for fun, I looked at an old one, and it says Pacific Bond Company. So there's a guy named D, and I think his middle initial is T, and his last name is CC. So that's the guy that's got your stuff. Yeah, DTCC. And you can do that all with capital letters and Google it, and you can see where DTCC lives. It's an international entity. It's pretty neat when you guys want to really get into this and understand who you are and what they've done for us. Now, I got to tell you, they've done a great job in some aspects of providing some serious funding and benefits because of this certificate. That's a routing number. That's one of the presidents right there that set up all this corporate stuff. Do you guys know that in 1760, they had way more knowledge? The average family had way more knowledge about corporate law, contract law, and trust law than even some of the best paid attorneys today have. When they came to America, they came here for freedom, and they came here to retain titles. They didn't want anybody telling them that they couldn't speed on their horse because they had the title to their horse. They had a brand on it. They didn't want to be told that they couldn't plant crops in their yard or have a certain color paint on their house. They came here for freedom, but they came here for respect for each other. So if old George Washington wanted to paint his barn yellow, I'd let him, and I would uphold his right to have a yellow barn instead of complain about it and go to the, what are those, HOAs, Homeowners Association, and complain about it and try and get his yellow paint removed. There's a big responsibility to have that kind of authority, and there's also a big responsibility to uphold someone else's authority. So I'm just touched on that for a minute. Titles. Now, the executor, I looked up some words to go with executor. This is what the noun says. We good? It says the person appointed to administer the estate of a person. Does anybody know what person means? Say it.
Corporation.
Corporation. Who has died leaving a will, and that means like my will. My will to be here tonight, I was here. His will is to eat shrimp. So he has a will. That's what we mean by when we say will. Which nominates, I like the word nominate. I nominate me to be wealthy. Second it. My wife gave me a second. All opposed? Any opposed? The ayes have it. Unless there is a valid objection, the judge will appoint the person named in the will to be the executor. Now, here's what's crazy. If nobody appoints an executor to an estate, the state appoints one for you. Now, a lot of times that could be, say, an attorney. It could be prosecuting attorney. It could be the judge. It could actually be the clerk of the court. It may be an administrator for an alphabet company. It's kind of like hide the pea under the shell game. When you get there, you go, what's going on? Hey, what's going on? Hey, I'm a sovereign. I have rights. I have this. I have that. Really? Where's your executor? What's that? I'll point him. Okay, you're going to jail. Great. That quick. Bang. You're in. Okay, and they administer your will while you're in there. Now, that's really great because they're digging into your account. Is this cool?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go on a little farther. The executor must ensure that the person's desires expressed in the will are carried out. Practical responsibilities including gathering up and protecting the assets of the estate. Have you done all you can do to gather up the assets of your estate? I have. I got it all piled up, and I got a UCC 1 on it. That's really good news for anybody that doesn't have that done, because if I can tell you I did it, you can do it. If little old Bill right here can figure this stuff out, little old you can do too. It's really great. Okay, so now that we got protecting the assets of the estate, we need to obtain information in regarding to all beneficiaries named in the will and any other potential heirs, collecting and arranging for payments of debts of the estate, approving or disapproving creditors' claims. And I got to tell you this, I'm going to approve them all. I don't have any problem. I don't want any controversy. I want to settle it up the minute they give it to me. I want to accept all claims. Okay? Okay, making sure estate taxes are calculated, forms filed, and tax payments made, and in all ways assist the attorney for the estate, which the executor can select. I pick me because I don't want an attorney at law. I want an attorney in law. See, when you're at the river, you're not really wet. When you're in the river, you're all in. Okay? So we don't want to practice at law. We want to be in law because that's where it's at. When you get in the pool, I'm going to tell you right now, all the rest of the guys at law don't want to get in the pool with you. And if you're the only guy in the pool, there's only one story being told. You guys following me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as we go on, there's some things, words, like I'm getting into this word called advocate. And the word advocate means to speak or write in favor of, support or urge by argument, recommend publicly, and then it gives a sentence, he advocated higher salaries for the teachers. The noun word of advocate is a person who speaks or writes in support or defense of a, what's person?
Corporation,
cause, etc., usually followed by an advocate of peace. A person who pleads for or in behalf of another, or a person who pleads the cause of another in a court of law. Okay? That's an advocate. Now, advocate has the word vocate in it, right? So if we understand revocate, that's the revenue of something. Now, if you hear the word Internal Revenue Service, if we tear down the word Internal Revenue Service, the word revenue stands out like it doesn't even stand out. Revenue. We think it's money. It means the revenue. If you're a musician, you know what a venue is. That's where you're playing. It's a specific thing. To revenue means you move it to somewhere else. So the internal revenue service is taking your money and putting it into another venue. So the word advocate comes also from a word vocate, which means to speak in on behalf of. So if we're going to revocate, comes another word off of that is revocation. So the word revocation means to recall or to call back. To the act of instance of revoking. Now, how can you revoke something? We can't as citizens because we gave up the right to revoke. Right? Only the king can revoke something because he had it in first position. I give something to this gentleman right here and I go, I'm going to revoke your right to use it, give it back. Well, what if I gave him something but it was his to begin with? And I say, well, I'm going to revoke your right to travel. You don't have a driver's license. And he says, hey, I gave you the right to revoke, so I'm going to revoke your right to revoke my revoke. Are you seeing what I'm saying? We have the right to travel. We have the right to our personal effects. We have the right, and I like this word, we have the right to travel unfettered. Now, that's almost R-rated right there, unfettered. If anybody ever looks up that word, it's a great word, unfettered.
Harassed?
That's right. It's even worse than harassed. It's beheld. Okay. How can they pay you if they've held you against your will? How can they pay you back for the time you lost? They can't. 10 minutes is gone. You can't pay me back that. So, revocation. Revocation of power of attorney. Now, there's a nice sling of words all together, isn't it? Revocation of power of attorney. So let's go down the chain of events. Your parents got married. They gave up their right to all they are going to accumulate in the wording of the license of marriage. They gave it to the state. Remember how the state sounds a lot like estate? Okay. So now that they've given up all their rights to all their property, their children, anything that they accrue under that marriage, they've agreed to give up to the state. Now, when mom goes down and has the baby at the hospital, they won't let usually the dad sign the birth certificate because there would be two signatures on there. It would be twice as hard for them to prove this all in all later. But mom turns into an informant. And she gives up right and title to the child. That's why they take that birth certificate and send it off. The live birth lets them know there's a new estate being put into the system. So that goes to, this is crazy, it goes to the Treasury through the DTCC, and that is turned into a security and income or outgo goes into the system on your behalf. So now mom has just given up title to the child, and by giving up title, she gave power of attorney to the state to handle all your affairs. Excuse me, the child's affairs. I don't want to insult anyone. Now, if you don't revoke that power of attorney, if I give him over here the power of attorney in my affairs, and I go to court, and I start yelling and screaming, and he just sits there, and the judge says, where's the power, where's the man who has power of attorney? And let's say the prosecution stands up and goes, we agree to go to jail and to pay a fine of $15,000 and pay back the estate for this gentleman. How can I argue with that? I gave him power of attorney. See that? I can't argue with somebody that I gave power of attorney unless I revoke the power of attorney. Are you guys catching all this? Now, as we get older, we sign some other contracts. We give up power of attorney to our right to travel, to the officer, to the court, to the judge, to the clerk of the court. We give up power of attorney there. when we get old enough to have maybe a job. When I was younger, it was when you started working, 12, 13 years old, you went and got a Social Security number. So you gave up power of attorney to your estate's income and turn everything that you make into a taxable event. I like that. That's what I was looking for, a taxable event. So realistically, everything that we spend to any government agency is a tax. And we have given up power of attorney to argue any points. These guys that go into court and argue about tax law 28 and section code 15 and USC, all of it, it doesn't matter. You're not there as an attorney. You have to hire an attorney because you gave up power of attorney. So when we learn how to start revoking their authority that we gave them, because they can only have something that was given to them, remember that. You cannot create something bigger than yourself. So if they have the power or the authority to throw someone in jail, we have the power and authority to throw someone in jail. And if we gave them the power to do that, we can revoke that power. You guys following along with this okay?
Mm-hmm.
So revocation, a power of attorney, revocation of a driver's license. Now, here's the cool part. The Alphabet Group will say DMV, IRS, CIA, some of those other alphabet groups. Whenever they act like they're in charge, they're only in charge by our either acquiescence or by our permission. So whenever they pass a law, act slash, because there are no laws since 1933, remember that, there is no money. There are no laws. We're all acting under public policy. Whenever they pass a policy or an act, they have to give us remedy for the real man to get out of playing in the play. So there are lots and lots of forms that I've been finding on the internet under the IRS subsection that give us the power to revoke almost everything that they're doing. Isn't that great?
Awesome.
So we don't have to argue anymore. We don't have to go in as a debtor. We can go in as a creditor. Now, has anybody ever been in bankruptcy court? Just raise your hand real slow. But probably because people owe you money. But is it better to go in as a debtor or as a creditor?
Creditor.
And what's the job of the trustee for the bankruptcy for the estate that's bankrupt? To find out who the creditors are. That way they get paid. That's the deal. They don't really care who the debtors are because the debtors are indebted to a debtor. So if you walked in and you had a sign on that said debtor right here on your chest and the judge says, okay, we're going to find out who the creditors are so they can get paid, you could go right here. How about that? I'm no longer the debtor. I'm the creditor. And it looks like a corporation with two initials are the debtors, and I would like them to go ahead and pay me. And I'd like to use some of those alphabet guys over there to go collect it for me. Has anybody ever thought of that? There's a whole nother playing field. There's an old theory that there could be two complete planets operating in unison right on top of each other that you couldn't see parallel. Right on top of each other because molecular structure of wood is not the same as air and they can pass through each other. So what if we were operating in a matrix right now and as soon as you found out that you could pass out of where we're living right now and start flying in a whole other dimension, wouldn't you be interested in doing that?
Yeah.
And my answer is yes. This is great. I had an experience the other day. I went to a court and went in to file some paperwork. this is some funny stuff. I've been sent a notice saying that somebody was suing me. It was a credit card company. And they were looking for some money. Now, I know there ain't no money, so I was willing to settle with them. However, they didn't have the feeling that I had about money. And so they filed a small claims against me. Now, this is all great. No big deal. So I beat him in this one court. Because I beat him, the judgment went for three times the amount plus punitive damages. So instead of them getting $2,000, I'm owed $76,000. But the court says, well, it's in small claims, so we got to get it out of here. And besides, we know Bill, and we don't want that in our court. So they send it off to the Superior Court. So I get a notice from the Superior Court, if you want to continue with this case, you need to come down here and pay $168. Extortion, excuse me. Fraud, excuse me. A fee. For educational purposes only. Thank you for that. So I go down there and I stand in line behind a whole bunch of slaves. I didn't see the king's line anywhere. I asked for it. I said, hey, do I have to wait in this line? I'm not one of them. They said, yeah, just for a minute. And I said, okay, I'll respect the time of my brothers. So when I got to the counter, I said, hey, I got this notice and it's bothering me. She goes, why is it bothering you? I said, because I'm the respondent. And according to the rules of procedure, a respondent doesn't have to pay to prove his innocence. Now, whoever brought, this is what I told her, whoever brought the controversy also must bring the remedy. That's law. That's law as a maxim. So I said, so I want you to go ahead and open up a file on this for me. So she reads it and she goes, oh no, I can't do that. You have to pay $168. I said, well, if it says there that I get $1 million if I win, do it. Because I can write that in right now. I'll just write it on there. She goes, no. What I meant was, if you want to pursue this, you have to pay $168. And I said, well, I really didn't want to do this. But if you're not going to go ahead and charge the credit card company, then I authorize you to access the replevin bond that they filed when they filed this suit against me. She goes, I need to get my supervisor. I go, ready.
Say that one more time. You need to do what?
I told them that they needed to take the money out of the replevin bond that the credit card company was required to file when they filed suit against me. A replevin bond is an insurance policy just in case they made a mistake, like they sued a real man instead of the straw man, right, and they didn't spell it right, and maybe they thought there was real money, and I was supposed to pay back with real money. And all these other things like the gold standard and HGR 192 and public law 7310, I mean, they were really messed up, okay? They made a huge mistake when they messed with the real man. And I don't want to get too excited about this. But anyway, so the lady comes back and she goes, our supervisor's out to lunch. I go, 3 o'clock, are you kidding me? So I said, okay, well, here, I want you to give her this note and I want you to give it to her in private. So I accepted their offer, and I return it with my signature and a stamp and a thumbprint on it, if you guys know what I'm talking about. And she goes, she looks at it, and I said, I will go ahead and effect payment this one time on this case, but I expect reimbursement for this. Do you understand that? And she looks at it, and she goes, oh, that's good. So she puts it in the file, and she takes off, and she goes, I'll have Maureen Green call you when she comes in. I said, great. So I don't get a phone call. Nothing. A couple of weeks later, I get a pile of paperwork from the attorney's office because they were out of date 90 days past the due date when they were supposed to respond. Now I've got them in default. And so I said, well, now that they've opened up the deal, I'm going to go ahead and go ahead and file this. So I went back to the clerk of the court and I said, hey, I need to file this into the case. This is an order for the judge to sign because they're in default. And according to rules and procedures, they lost. So I need you to... She goes, well, there's no file number. I go, oh, really? I came in here and paid for it.
Oh, did you pay the 168 or whatever it was?
I accepted their bill and told them where to go get it. The estate is responsible for paying that, right? Okay, for educational purposes only. So she says, she's looking at the screen and she goes, no, I don't have any. And then you can see her. She goes, there's nothing in here. I'm like, oh. Are you Bill? How about that? Have you seen me on the videos? What? I said, no, I am Bill, and there was supposed to be a file opened. I effected payment here several weeks ago, and I still haven't gotten noticed. And she goes, I need to get my supervisor. I'll be right back. So the next lady comes up, and she says, she has a pile of paperwork, and she goes, hi, are you Bill? I said, I'm the authorized representative, probably for the one that you're referring to. Do you need to speak with me? She goes, I would like to in private. I said, great. How about that? I'm in the private side already. Bang! So I walk over to this private room, and she says, we need $168 to open this file. And I said, I already paid it. And so I said, let me see that. So I just reach over, and I take the file from her, and she hands it to me. Isn't that cool? When you're the king, you just ask for things to happen, and they happen. I take the page, and I flip it over, and I go, how about that? There's an A for V right there on the front. See, I paid for that. You have notice right here. I paid for it. Now, what's the problem? She goes, well, we don't recognize that. I said, that's because you haven't opened up a file. If you opened up a file and took that to the judge would recognize it, and everybody would be really happy right now, including me. And I'm not happy. You didn't take this. I said, so here's the case. Here's the order that I'm sending in, and this is the file, and you need to take this and have the judge sign this. So open up a file and do that for me. So she takes it from me, and she goes, well, I'll have to find out about that. Thank you. I said, great. Now, when she took that, what did she do?
Accepted for value.
Oh, she accepted my offer. I love that part. I really do. So I get a phone call a couple days later, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, past the 3 days. Looks like it was a week. They had 72 hours, right? 72 hours to reject my offer or to give me reason why they couldn't accept it because of the Fair Lending and Trading Act. So she says, I need to talk to you. We still need $168 to open this case. And I said, we got real problems now. Now, I said, I'll be in to talk to you in a little bit. Now, there's a whole lot of stuff that's going on. The first case that was filed, there's a replevin bond. That's in a little town called... And... Now, that judge up there didn't want to hear the deal, and as soon as it got out of his jurisdiction, because it went over $10,000, they sent it to another place called... Now, if they forgot to send the replevin bond with it, there's a violation of an oath taken up there. Because in commerce, they have to send the money with the controversy. Right? So, somewhere the replevin bond's gone. So when I get home on Monday, I get to go over to my favorite court and say, hey, brother, I need to talk to the guy that's administrating this corporation here and talk to him about the replevin bond that didn't make it to fight. Because they don't have any record of it. For educational purposes only. When somebody files a lawsuit, they have to put in there a bid bond, which means if you don't show up, that's the amount of the lawsuit. So the payment is already in effect paid. Now, some lawyers have bar numbers that also double as an insurance policy. Now, when you show up and respond to a offer, they have to post another bond. It's called a performance bond. The performance bond is 3 times the amount of the original bid bond. Just in case they damage you, you walk away with the gusto. Now, has anybody ever been convicted of a crime, sentenced, brought before a judge to stand trial and won? Has anybody ever done that? Okay. Whatever the amount of your case was, there was 3 times the amount put into a bond. So when you won, did you go back there and say, hey, I need my money, honey? They don't tell us that. So when you leave it there, they get to collect it because you abandoned that money.
You're crooks.
We're not crooks. You just didn't find out the rules yet. I'm just telling you a few of the rules for entertainment purposes only. Okay, so now there's this whole deal with replevin. Replevin means to reinsure. Okay. Now, this whole system is in place for us, guys. All we have to do is learn how to operate in it. Now, when I gave that lady my documents, it says in Admiralty. That is a port. Now, there's another port called statutory. There's another port called common law. There's several ports that you can place documents in a court. But when you hand some documents to the clerk of the court, they have a responsibility to deliver those to the right port. Because if they don't, they violated a thing called
trust.
Not only trust, but the Bill of Lading Act. If you guys want some really interesting stuff, read the Bill of Lading Act and start thinking about the shipper as a clerk of the court and the port as admiralty or common law. Now, I love admiralty. Admiralty is really good for me because that has to do with contract. So let me give you a couple of things that make a contract valid. Two signatures signed with wet ink by two living people. The second thing is both of those people had to be of majority age, over 18. The third thing is all the things in that contract have to be disclosed. The fourth thing is there has to be a mutual benefit for both sides. It can't be one-sided. And five, I'm going to have to think about that one.
Offer and acceptance.
It has to be accepted. Offer and acceptance. So, once we have all that into place, how many people have seen their credit card transactions with two signatures on them? Okay. How about the application? Okay. How about your driver's license? How about Social Security? Okay. Well, that just about covers the two signatures. So now we're operating under, objectively, an adhesion contract that's only enforceable when you agree to it. Is everybody okay with all this? We can win on every issue. I love Admiralty. When you bring my vessel into port, man, I've got cannons now. And I'm looking over there at their BB guns, and it's not good. Now, if I revoke their power of attorney to speak on my behalf, who can speak in court when I'm there?
Nobody.
Nobody, because I'm the only real man there. See, they're all actors. Everybody's dead there. They're all corporations acting on behalf of a corporation. So anyway, I'm going to wrap it up here tonight to tell you that being an executor is really a cool thing. But there's a lot of responsibility, especially if you want to be the settler in that trust. So don't take this lightly, but remember that you cannot lose if you're well prepared. Is everybody excited?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for coming out tonight. We appreciate y'all. Well, Winston Shroud speaks on it. I have to do that. What they're really saying and what the officer's hearing is, I'm a slave, I live on the plantation, and I don't want to be, but I don't have the guts to get out and do what it takes so that I can operate in commerce without any controversy. So I don't like using the word sovereign. But if you get out and you tell them that you don't have a driver's license, and you know how to defend that when you get to court, that's really a great thing. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
So I do have one, but I don't show it. I need it for opening up bank accounts, and I need it for maybe checking out books at the library to get a card. My straw man, I shouldn't say mine, the straw man that's operating as an entity, he needs it. He needs to open up bank accounts, and he needs to, say, maybe pick up his mail at the office when he forgets his mail key. So, I mean, there's things that it's good for, but I don't like to use that for contract purposes. Okay?
How does that keep you? I mean, doesn't that put you in dishonor with the officer that you've got one and you say you don't?
Who has one? The last time I looked at the straw man, he's got a condo. It's a P.O. box that's about this big.
Right.
It's really nice. That's where he lives. That's the port in which the U.S. corporation goes through. And what they're hoping is that the trustee shows up to pick up his mail.
Right.
For about a year now, the trustee has not picked up his mail. The beneficiary and the executor has been picking up his mail. Come on, man. Smile.
I'm listening.
Okay. So, I don't have a driver's license. The estate does. So, when the officer pulls a car over that I happen to be traveling in, and he asks for a driver's license, I have to tell him, the guy that has a driver's license is dead. Now, I'm driving him around right now, but I don't need one to travel, so are you following me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You actually say that to an officer?
Oh, yeah. My wife, if you can get my wife to sit down and talk with you for 5 minutes, she can tell you some stories. Okay. Any other questions before we go?
Does she laugh when she...
Oh, yeah, she says, oh, yeah, she's just laughing. If anybody knows my wife, she's very serious.
One of the things that they said, I was reading something along the same lines you're talking about, was that they're training up the police. And if you come up with this sovereign, they're automatically going to be trying to put handcuffs.
Red alert, that's right. That's right.
So one of the lawyers I was talking with, and a lawyer that's into this rather than, anyway, says, you're we the people.
Right.
He said what?
I'm one of the people.
He said he's one of the people, instead of saying he's a sovereign.
There's, I'm one of the people.
There are so many great remedies, there's so many ways to handle it, that you have to figure out something that works, and when it works for you, don't change it. Okay? There's a lot of ways to answer questions when you get pulled over. If you were traveling at 100 mile an hour in a 55, you should be concerned about the well-being of the other sovereign people around you, and probably maybe not do that. If you're traveling with your seatbelt pulled down underneath your arm and you get pulled over, you might want to accept his offer and return it right away. There's a lot of things that you can do to remedy a problem. Now remember, since 1933, all crimes are commercial. Commercial means it has to do with money. And the next sentence, in 1933, they tell us that they're is no money. There's only credit. Go ahead.
What about car insurance?
I pay for car insurance. I do. I can't get any windshield companies to A for V a windshield yet. And I get a rock in my window. It seems like every 4 or 5 months I get a nice new bullet hole right there in the front. So I carry insurance. I think it's a great thing to have. If you can afford it, that's great. If you can't afford it, then there's some other remedies. You know, I mean, you might ask your estate to pay for that, because that's one of the things the executors do. They make sure that after the testator dies, the grass in the front yard of this place needs to be watered, and the house needs to be kept up real well, because you never know, he might need to sell it to pay for something. So you want to make sure that all of his property is upkept. Okay? So that might be insurance for them, whatever you think. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
One more.
Okay, way back there in the back. Question is, can you explain briefly about signing an offer? We call them offers or contracts. The 14th Amendment citizens, or the U.S. citizens in the slave camp, they like to call them tickets. Okay. Before I get into that question right there, because I don't want to get out of the box. But when you get to court, the judge places an order, right? He tells you, okay, I order you to do this, right? Or I order you to do that. Is that correct?
Yeah.
When you go to McDonald's and you place an order, who has to pay for the order?
You.
Okay. So the next time the judge places an order,
you pay for it.
It's on him to pay for it. Okay, so when you get pulled over by an officer, there's a couple of things that really wreak havoc back at the corporation that ticket's going to be sent to, where the administrator that wears a dress will see it. Nobody's laughing. Okay. If you put a box around your name, if you understand the four corners rule, if you see a document that has square brackets around it, Carla, I wish you would bring, did you bring your thing?
No.
Maybe go look at Carla's, too bad. She got a notice from an attorney or a real estate agent or somebody, and it was saying that the bank name in boxes is requiring you to move out of your house, and that they have title in boxes to the place, and that there's conflict, right? Well, everything that was in boxes was not on the contract. So you could take a pen and write through it so it's not there and then read the contract. And if it makes sense, you still got a contract. If it doesn't make any sense, then the whole contract is void. So anything in a box is not on the contract. Does that make sense?
Can you actually draw a line through it?
If you make a box around the signature area and then sign inside the box, if an officer has ever been to court where they've thrown the ticket out, he'll be really upset that you do that. But if he's not quite up to speed on things, that's one way to handle an offer. The other way is to sign it as an authorized representative. Now, that's the way I like to do things for informational and educational and entertainment purposes. And if you look in UCC 401, I believe it is, it says that any signature that is unambiguous has been unambiguously signed. Now, if you look up unambiguous, it comes from the word ambiguous, which means to hide or be deceptive or deceitful. So if it's unambiguously signed, authorized representative, and then you sign your name, it says in the UCC code that that signer is not responsible for anything on the contract. So if you sign it that way and you don't show up in court, they may give you some lenience because you signed it as a authorized representative for a dead guy, say. But before you do that, make sure you understand how you're going to defend all that. Okay, you may want to show up as a real guy and let him know by way of the death certificate, excuse me, the birth certificate. Are you guys following me?
Yeah.
Had a judge one time say, well, if William isn't here today, then I'll just issue a warrant for his arrest. And I said, well, let me go ahead and give you the defendant now. Can I visit him? And he goes like this to the bailiff.
Is that his birth certificate?
And the bailiff goes, yes, it is. Let's give it back to him. That's fine. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah.
Let me get this guy here. He hasn't had a chance yet.
Can you explain the difference between a birth certificate and a certificate of live birth?
Yeah, a certificate of live birth is what they fill out for you at the hospital for the woman who is now the informant that's abandoning the child. That's a live birth. That gets sent off to a warehouse receipt company. That's good. And they put that onto a stock certificate. They turn it into a security, and then they monetize it. So that's a certificate. Anything that's a certificate means that you gave up title to. So if you have a certificate, let's say a certificate of title on a car, that's not the title. The title's gone. You lost it. Certificate of title means somebody else owns it. They're just giving you something to verify to you that they own your stuff.
Oh, wow.
Got it? The only thing that's true title is a manufacturer statement of origin.
What is that for in the birth?
Certificate of live birth? Well, I would say a manufacturer statement of origin would probably predate a certificate of live birth, too. If you know what I'm saying.
By 9 months.
Go ahead.
It's called an affidavit of conception.
An affidavit of conception is a great thing. manufacturer statement of origin is a little better for me because I'm kind of a hands-on, you know, mechanic kind of guy. Okay. Go ahead.
What'd you call?
Birth certification.
What does it mean?
Birth certification.
It's a lot smaller, and it doesn't. It's not really attached to a security. So, but does anybody need a certificate to prove that I was born?
No.
I mean, I'm here.
No,
hello.
Hello.
Okay, so where were you born? Around here somewhere. I was born on the earth. God's planet. Hello.
God's planet.
All right.
Too young to remember.
Hey, yeah, that's another thing. That's a great one. When they ask you what your birth date was, can anybody absolutely tell what day they were born?
No.
Without a shadow of a doubt. It's all hearsay, isn't it? Your parents told you, your teacher told you. I told that to the judge. I don't know. I was awful young when I was born. I can't remember a lot of stuff back then. And if I told you what my parents told me, that would be hearsay, and that's inadmissible as evidence in this court of law. How about that? Okay. So you guys, are you done? Have we had enough? All right.
I need a lot.